Christmas was on its way. Lovely, glorious, beautiful Christmas around which the entire kid year revolved.
Fragile. It must be Italian.
Welcome, everybody. John Carlson, right back at it here. Talk Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. The radio program of record for this 19th day of December. 19th day of December. You know what that means, you men? Time to start your Christmas shopping, ladies and gentlemen.
4 days to Festivus.
Yeah, that too. Welcome back, John.
Oh, you guys did fine while I was gone for a few days.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Yeah. We had lots to choose from.
Well, and we got a lot to choose from today as well. Boy, oh boy, local and national. The big national story is, of course, the collapse of the so-called budget deal between Republicans and Democrats in Congress, because Donald Trump doesn't like it very much. And this 1,500-page monstrosity that was heatedly opposed, not just by Donald Trump, but by people on his team, led by Elon Musk, helped to crater this. It also didn't help that they tried to sneak in a pay raise. A pay raise was kind of quietly tucked into the language. I'll tell you something. People, by and large, don't like pay raises for politicians. But you know what they really, really, really hate is when you try and sneak through a pay raise. If you're going to call for a pay raise, you know, be up front and let people know it's coming. And that's obviously not what happened here. Will there be a government shutdown tomorrow? Well, there will be if Congress doesn't pass a bill to keep the government funded. The opposition from here's it's very simple. It's very simple. There will not be a budget deal to keep things open unless Donald Trump allows it to happen. Unless Donald Trump allows it to happen. Now, he doesn't have to endorse it as, oh, this is great. This is right in line with what we want. One of the reasons Donald Trump is president was to end business as usual, and he's not yet president, not for another, well, not for another month, right? But there's absolutely no doubt who's in charge. There's absolutely no doubt that what Donald Trump says matters a whole heck of a lot more than what Joe Biden says. Here's a statement from President-elect Donald Trump and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance. Quote, the most foolish and inept thing ever done by congressional Republicans was allowing our country to hit the debt ceiling in 2025. It was a mistake. And now it is something that must be addressed. Meanwhile, Congress is considering a spending bill that would give sweetheart provisions for government censors and for Liz Cheney. The spending bill would actually make it easier to hide the records of the corrupt January 6th committee, which accomplished nothing for the American people, while hiding security failures that happened on that day. The security failures are hidden for a very simple reason. They were the fault of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, who's in charge of the Capitol Police Force. This bill would also give Congress a pay increase while many Americans are struggling this Christmas. Increasing the debt ceiling is not great, but we'd rather do it on Biden's watch. If Democrats won't cooperate on the debt ceiling now, what makes anyone think they would do it in June during our administration? Let's have the debate now. And we should pass a streamlined spending bill that doesn't give Chuck Schumer and the Democrats everything they want. By the way, I gotta you know, be clear, be honest here. Democrats are trying to cram in as much last-minute spending as possible, but so are Republicans. Republicans are also trying to cram it with spending and special favors. You know, farm state senators, the corn lobby, which is mostly in red states, has the most influence in red states. So it's not just the Democrats, but let's continue. Republicans want to support our farmers, pay for disaster relief, and set our country up for success in 2025. The only way to do that is with a temporary funding bill without Democrat giveaway combined with an increase in the debt ceiling. Anything else is a betrayal of our country. Republicans must get smart and tough. If Democrats threaten to shut down the government unless we give them everything they want, then call their bluff. It is Schumer and Biden who are holding up aid to our farmers and disaster relief. This chaos would not be happening if we had a real president. We will in 32 days. Again, that is a joint statement from President Trump and J.D. Vance. Yesterday, Donald Trump also posted a shorter statement on his Truth Social account. Said, if Republicans try to pass a clean, continuing resolution without all the Democrat bells and whistles that will be so destructive to our country, all it will do after January 20th is bring the mess of the debt limit into the Trump administration rather than allowing it to take place in the Biden administration. Any Republican that would be so stupid as to do this will be primary. Everything should be done and fully negotiated prior to my taking office on January 20th, 2025. In other words, fix it now. And if you're not going to fix it now, at least don't make it worse. If you're not going to fix it now, don't make it worse. So as soon as Donald Trump weighed in big time, and as soon as Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and others did, that bill collapsed. And so we will see what happens next. But I'll tell you something. This bill needed to be stopped because all it would have done is just enhance everything that is wrong with Washington, D.C., and say, hurry, let's get all this done. Let's get all of this put together before Trump comes to town, because, you know, when Trump comes to town, ride's over for us. So it is good to see him weigh in big time. And what a difference between how Donald Trump wants things handled on the federal level and what you see in Olympia at the state level, which we'll get into a little later in the show. By the way, speaking of Trump and speaking of 32 days, I'm hearing really good information, a clue that our listeners are going to be able to observe what happens on Inauguration Day with the KVI news team. What are you hearing, young Zach?
I've heard some rumblings about that. I think we'll have some big breaking news on that subject tomorrow morning.
That's going to be announced tomorrow. If you don't have plans for January 20th, well, why don't you just mark that day and plan to join us? It'll be somewhere on the east side, East King County?
Nope, going to be downing South King County for a change.
Southeast King County. Huh? We just want you to know that something is in the works, and it should be a lot of fun. And we'll be ready to announce it tomorrow morning, first and foremost, on the commute with Carlson, right? Okay, there's a lot of other stuff we're going to get to. Terrible story, and it'll be our lead local story here at 6:35. For the first time in many years, a Metro bus driver has been killed in the line of duty. Sean Yim, who is 59 years old, was stabbed in the chest in the wee hours of Wednesday morning on a bus that was going through the U District, but it was, you know, a part of the U District that is not really known for having a lot of trouble. There was a lot of trouble at 15th Avenue and Northeast 41st when Sean Yim and a passenger got in some sort of an altercation, and the driver was stabbed, killed. This is so bad for so many reasons. Not only for the family of Mr. Yim, but also what it says about public transit in King County in general and Seattle in particular. Washington school districts will be proposing a ban on boys who say that they're girls participating in girls' sports. We've got some interesting info about the firing of Seattle's police chief and why it's hard to look at all the evidence and not conclude that he brought it on himself. Absolutely chilling statistic just out. The Emerson poll showing that 41% of young people, 41%, find the killing of Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare's insurance company, acceptable. This does not portend well for what it says about this country and young people. Also, have you guys heard about this new phenomenon? You've heard about people who squat in people's homes, squatting where they go into an unoccupied home.
Right, yeah.
And just move in.
Start living, yeah.
And say, well, if you want us out, you have to go through an expensive, laborious, time-consuming...
Yeah, court dates and judges' rulings and
legal
things like
process.
That.
Mm-hmm. Have you now heard that this phenomenon is making its way to airline travel?
That I did not hear.
Seat squatting on airplane is now a thing.
So you roll in, you sit down in first class and don't move.
Or it's easier to get away with in coach.
Yeah.
Okay. In economy class, where people will sit and just refuse to give up their seat.
As long as...
And even though it's not their seat. Anyway... We will talk about that as well and a whole bunch of other things.
I'm going to use that at the luxury suite at the sports stadium the next time I go to a ball game.
Diamond Club squatting.
Oh, it reminds me of the old Bob Uecker commercial. I don't even remember what the product was, but yeah. Here he is sitting in these great seats.
Great seats, eh, buddy?
And
like, no, sir.
People are looking at him.
Your
like,
seats are up
what's
there.
What's he doing there? And then here comes the usher. Hey, come on, buddy. No, no, those aren't your seats. Oh, I must be in the front row.
Yep. The uke.
Anyway, it is coming up on 20 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. The John Carlson Show. Christmas is 6 days away. Have you shopped and found a present for that loved one? Your favorite friend, your favorite colleague at work, your favorite radio talk show host. It's very important you get on top of this as the Commute with Carlson continues. Good morning. 24 minutes after 6 o'clock. Okay, you want to hear an interesting little anecdote about this song? I didn't know you were about to play it. Young Zach surprises me.
Is this the guy who used to own KVI and Como?
That was exactly the question I was going to ask him.
Yeah. The singing cowboy, Gene Autry.
Gene Autry.
Gene Autry didn't want to play this song. Didn't want to sing the song. You know, they came to him and said, what do you think? And he heard it and he went, no, that's not me. He changed his mind because his wife loved it.
Huh? Wives can be persuasive, I found.
So he said, I tell you what, you know, he was playing a concert at Madison Square Garden and they said, we'll play it and see how the crowd reacts. Again, this is a country singer. And they fired up the song. They played it. It was during the holiday season. I forget what year it was, you know, 1956, 57, something like that. The crowd went crazy. The crowd loved it. And so Gene Autry said, well, all right then. And it became one of the best-selling Christmas songs of that era. Anyway, there you go. It's something you might not have known about this song during the holidays.
Good musical Christmas history.
Yes. Been recorded by many, many, many people.
Yeah.
Over
and
the
how
years.
How many times kids used to sing this on the playground and then they'd insert their own parenthetical lyrics into the song?
Which we
you
really
know,
can't always
may not always
repeat.
Be fit for radio.
Yeah. So I know what's fit for radio. It's the social media sweep with Senior Chief Executive Producer Philip J. Vandenbort III.
Yeah. Governor Jay Inslee update is what we're going to call this. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. So Governor Inslee's facing a giant budget deficit and he's required by state constitution to propose a balanced budget. And then, of course, that gets haggled out by the state legislature. Brandy Cruz is pointing this out about the proposal Jay Inslee made a couple days ago. And it's headlined by, of course, reliance on a wealth tax, which Jeff Bezos is a big fan of, from what I understand. Brandy Cruz, the podcast host, pointed out Washington State's economy will never recover if Democrats don't back away from their proposal for a wealth tax. The quickest way to scare away wealth and businesses is to target them for taxation because you can't control your spending. And it's really no surprise that Inslee does this as the lame duck. He doesn't have to be around to be there for any of the impact of this or any of the debate on this. He just has to submit it And then he leaves office. Bob Ferguson takes over and the legislature ends up having to sort out what the problem is with our state budget. So this is purely obligatory by Inslee. But what I think he's doing is he's essentially pulling the pin on a hand grenade in Olympia and then walking away because he's the lame duck governor. And I think this budget proposal shows that he's really not a serious person or a public official by what he's proposing.
Great point. Jay Inslee has been governor for 12 years, just about 12 years. And for 11 years and 11 months, he has never called for a wealth tax. And here he is on his way out the door, tossing the idea. Now, why would he be doing this? I'll tell you why I think he's doing it. I think he's trying to pave the way, to make it thinkable, to make it plausible, to make it even politically appealing to Democrats to consider pushing for it under the new governor, Bob Ferguson, next month.
And I'm sure Bob Ferguson will be happy to champion a wealth tax. I don't think he's going to oppose it.
I think he's going to have a much tougher road to hoe than people think.
Well, here's what Inslee said about his new proposed budget at a press conference. I guess this would have been Tuesday. Here's what Inslee said.
Today we are proposing a balanced budget. I want to repeat this. We are proposing a balanced budget.
Ooh, he's repeating
And that's important. For the fiscal integrity of the state of Washington.
It's also legally required.
I'm just going to say, what do you want, a cookie, Jay? You're obligated by the state constitution to submit and pass a balanced budget.
You can't.
You don't have any other choice, and you're acting like you're doing us a favor.
You can't propose any other kind of budget if you are the governor of Washington State. It's not like the federal government.
Yeah.
The state constitution requires you propose and that the legislature ultimately pass a balanced budget.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It shows Inslee has no credibility. And if he did have credibility, he would have submitted a viable, reasonable budget proposal. Now, one other item on social media for Governor Inslee. This is an award he just received from the Idaho governor. Brad Little is the Idaho governor. Did you hear about this award?
I think I know what it is, but go ahead.
It's a major award.
It is a major award. Brad Little posted on his X account, at Governor Little, the Idaho governor, that he has bestowed Jay Inslee as the Idaho Realtor of the Year because of all the insipid political decisions, fiscal, taxation, budgetary decisions Jay Inslee has made that are prompting people to leave the state of Washington and, in some cases, go and move to Idaho.
That'll make up for his
congratulations, Governor Inslee.
That'll make up for his crippling comments on the Idaho potato industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I guess these guys aren't friends.
Are they exchanging Christmas
cards
this year?
I'm guessing Jay and Governor Little and Idaho aren't buddies. Look, I got to tell you, Idaho is growing. It's one of the fastest growing states in the country. It's in the top 10. Washington State, under Jay Inslee, for I believe the first time since we became a state, stopped growing and actually lost more people than it gained. More out-migration than in-migration. And we would have had even steeper losses had it not been for illegal immigration. So, hey, Jay Inslee, heck of a legacy you've got there. It is coming up, my goodness, 6:31. When we come back, we've got some details about that awful killing of a Metro bus driver and what it says about public transit in King County. Coming right up. All right, you got 24 minutes to 7 o'clock. Did a little more homework here on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the song that we played, the Gene Autry version. Turned out, I said it was the 1950s. Technically, it became a number one hit in January 1950, but it was selling and climbing the charts in Christmas season 1949. It was released as a children's record. Again, Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, didn't want to release it. His wife convinced him, and when he performed it for a live audience in New York, they loved it. So he released it as a children's record, and it was so popular that Columbia Records said, I think this is going to be like a general hit. So they released it marketed it as a general song. Went to number one for the week ending January 7th, making it the first hit of the 1950s. It sold, the Gene Autry version, over 12 million records throughout the 50s and beyond. It is the second hottest selling Christmas song ever. Do you know the first?
Mariah Carey.
No.
What's the Ronettes Sleigh Ride?
I'll repeat myself exactly. No.
Ooh, swing and a miss.
Bing Crosby.
Oh,
White Christmas.
Okay.
Bing Crosby, the pride of Tacoma, Washington.
It's a good standard.
Or is it Spokane?
Right.
The two cities have battled back and forth for his legacy. Anyway,
it's Spokane, Adam. They deserve something.
Be nice. We like the Spokane area. Spokane city politics is a little crazy. Spokane area is a lovely place. All right. We got to do this story, and it's very sad, and it's very indicative of some really deep problems in King County. 59-year-old Sean Yim, Metro bus driver, was maced, sprayed in the face with mace by a passenger who then dragged him off the bus he was driving and stabbed him to death in an alley. This happened just over 24 hours ago, in the middle of the night, about 3 a.m. yesterday. Como's Kelly Koopmans has more.
The urgent search continuing for the man who allegedly killed a Metro bus driver in Seattle. New surveillance video showing the moments before that driver was stabbed. Video from SDOT shows the Metro bus pull up here and stop. The bus, then headlights go off, and you see two people come out of the door right there. There appears to be some kind of a commotion between the two before one walks over into the alley. Eventually, you can see what is believed to be the suspect standing in the street before taking off moments before police arrive on the scene.
Okay. Jeremy Harris interviewed a witness to the murder. Again, if you've got young ears in the car, a little caution here. This is a witness describing a murder.
A witness who was on the bus spoke with Como News, but asked his voice to be disguised due to fear for his own safety. He told us a fight started over the driver keeping a side window open.
The bus driver says, you know what, this is your last stop. You could just exit my bus, please. Thank you. He pushes past the plastic protector for the bus. He attempts to mace him first, starts going crazy nonstop.
Okay, the witness voice distorted maybe a little bit too much, but the bus driver pulled over when the passenger began acting even, you know, more temperamental and said, you know what, this is your last stop. You can exit my bus, please. Thank you. And the assailant pushes past the plastic protector for the driver. And he tries to mace the driver and then goes crazy. And the bus driver yells, hey, that's assault. That's assault. And at that point, the assailant drags the driver off the bus and stabs him. The passenger said, the bus driver's not coherent now. He's lost sight of everything. He was dead immediately. So, a couple of things. The first is, there was a press conference yesterday. And as the Seattle Times reports, and you can see it on the video of the press conference, there were transit union representatives and about 10 elected officials. You know who wasn't there? One elected official who wasn't there? The King County prosecutor was not there. You know, you would think that a prosecutor, because they would have a direct role in what would happen next, say, please help authorities find this man because we intend to prosecute him to the fullest extent of the law. This is outrageous. But there was no King County prosecutor there. There was a King County councilwoman, Claudia Balducci, who is going to run for county executive next year. And there was Vandana Slatter. Vandana is a state legislator who is got the inside track to move from the state house to the state senate. But both of those elected officials are from East King County. This incident happened in Seattle. What are they doing at the press conference? What's their particular niche? What's their angle on this story? Other than the fact that they're both seeking higher office, what are they there for? What are they there to contribute? The other thing that was interesting is that This is not a King County police investigation. This is a Seattle police investigation. Seattle police are heading the investigation. No one was at the conference from the Seattle Police Department. So the most relevant area of government, the most relevant government official should have been a spokesperson or a police captain or even Sue Rahr, the interim chief. They should have been at the press conference because they have something relevant to say. Their SPD is heading the investigation. They weren't there. King County police, King County sheriff's officials were there to say how they felt about the murder, which is nice. They feel terrible about the murder. But other than that, they said, well, SPD is handling this investigation. And yet they're not at the press conference. The one county official who would be most relevant to this, of course, would be the prosecutor, Lisa Manion. She wasn't there. But they have all these other politicians on the stage. Dow Constantine was there, but you know he's someone who has some explaining to do. And again, what was his contribution? Well, to let people know that the vast majority of trips on the system are very safe. Okay. And your point? Look, the bottom line on all this is, and I've said this 100 times before, if a store, if a public plaza, if a government building or public transit is not safe, then people won't go there. So if there's an area of town that isn't safe, people will go out of their way not to go there. It doesn't matter if you say, well, the vast majority of people are safe. Now, if it's a place you don't need to be and it's not safe, why would you go there? So this has been a problem with security on Metro, not just Metro, but Sound Transit. And the reason for it is, here we go again, tolerance policy on drugs and, frankly, on a tolerance policy on intolerable behavior on the bus. There have been 15 reported assaults on bus drivers this year through the month of November. There have doubtlessly been more than that, but those are the reported assaults. And there have been many, many more. I love this. Metro wasn't able to provide data for assaults involving passengers. Oh, really? You think they don't have that data? Of course they do. They're in no hurry to release it. Sound Transit reported nearly 80 assaults on passengers. Again, that's Sound Transit. 80 assaults on passengers during just the first 6 months of 2024. And this comes just a couple of days after Metro had to close 4 bus stops on 12th and Jackson. Not safe. Too many people being attacked at the bus stop, let alone on the bus. Our good buddy Lars Larson, our Noon to 3 host, checking in momentarily as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning. A beautiful sight. The John Carlson Show. Talk Radio 570 KVI. 7 minutes to 7 o'clock. We got to get Lars Larson here on the show today because I just have to flip a coin. I have no idea where he's going to come down on whether Republicans should vote for that 1,500-page spending bargain bill.
No.
Let's see where he, after anguished reading and review of this bill, where he comes down. Good morning, Lars.
Good morning, John, and no. Here's the 30,000-foot view. Mm-hmm. You just had Americans say, Biden's spending too much. We're replacing Biden with Trump. We're not taking Kamala, who planned to spend a lot as well. We've just given the Republicans their majority, barely in the House, majority in the Senate, and occupancy of the White House. And the Republicans walk in, and the first thing they do is propose, get this, $330 billion in new spending. Now, John, if you've got friends who are in money trouble and they say, John, I'm broke. I can barely pay my bills. But by the way, this weekend I'm heading off to this, you know, ski slopes. I'm going to spend a few days up at the mountain. And you say, hold on, you're in money trouble and you're going to spend more money? And some of this is for the dumbest stuff in the world. I'll give you one example. $200 billion in a new benefit for public employees, federal employees specifically. It has to do with Social Security, and that's going to cost $200 billion and accelerate the date at which Social Security goes broke, which is now 9 years away. And now it's probably 8 years or 7 years away. Second, a 40% raise for Congress. I realize they haven't had a raise since 2009, but here's the problem. the majority of members of Congress are millionaires, the majority. And the median net worth of Congress is over $1 million. And you say, and you want to give them a raise from $175,000 to $243,000 a year? Usually give raises if you can't attract people to a job.
And usually you give a raise to people who've done a good job.
Who've done a good job. So you've got that. And then there are a bunch of little, you know, smaller detail things that they've thrown into this. Funding for the State Department's Global Engagement Center. Do you know what that does? It's a censorship operation begun under Biden. And you'd think that, you know, and what's happening here is that the Democrats are saying to the Republicans, give us our wish list or we won't approve your budget. And the Republicans have immediately caved in. Now, should they have done that after the mandate of November 5th?
Yep. I say Donald, no spending bill should get through unless Donald Trump tips his hat and says it's acceptable to me.
And he's already said this one's a bust.
This one's a complete bust. It is coming up here 4 minutes to 7 o'clock, hour number two of the commute straight ahead. Talk radio 570 KVI. 3 minutes after 7 o'clock. Like I said, I've just been smiling since Election Day because almost all the news that we get about the election and its aftermath and the impact of it, almost all that news is good news, at least to me. And I always tell you why I think that is. The latest is that what probably would have gotten through last year, you know, a omnibus spending bill to prevent a government shutdown tomorrow, packed with pork and all sorts of incredibly unjustified spending items, is blown up. It's not going to happen. Donald Trump and Elon Musk have weighed in, and the agreement between House Speaker Mike Johnson and the Senate leadership, Chuck Schumer, which admittedly was a very delicate agreement, has collapsed. All it basically took was Donald Trump huffing and puffing at it, and he blew it down. That is a good thing. We'll talk more about that later. And you're probably wondering, hey, how does all this impact Donald Trump's popularity? Here's something you should know. I guarantee you, Americans are not pleased to see a congressional pay raise, a 40% congressional pay raise, snuck into this last-minute spending bill, which they thought, well, because everyone's distracted by the holidays, they won't notice.
Right. And if you think Congress is working hard, remember, about every 2 months, they take about a 2 week vacation.
Yeah. And they have a 3 day. Well, they work, you know, their district and everything. But D.C., they work 3 days a week.
Yes. Monday is a travel day. Friday is a travel day for your congressional members. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is when they, quote unquote, are in session or work.
The impact of Donald Trump's popularity since the election has been very positive. In fact, for the first time since Donald Trump entered American politics, for the first time, he has a net positive favorability rating. According to the Real Clear Politics polling average, 49.4% of American voters, 49.4%, have a favorable view of Donald Trump. 47.4 have an unfavorable view. And you're probably thinking, that's only 2 points in his favor. He's only net 2 points. But both times that he won the presidency, his unfavorable ratings were higher than his favorability rating. And he won anyway. He was in the high 30s in 2016. And he worked his way up to the low 40s. And this campaign, he was up in the mid 45 range, which is incredible considering all of the mud thrown on him, all of the attacks that were aimed at him. But Donald Trump actually now, for the first time since he entered politics, has more Americans viewing him favorably than unfavorably. So the Donald Trump that people see now is a Donald. And you know, we've talked about the changes, and I've noticed changes. I bet you have too. Donald Trump just seems happier. And Donald Trump seems more measured and more in command. I mean, every once in a while, he will kick back and roar, and he definitely left no doubt whatsoever about how he feels about this terrible spending bill. But he also just appears to be more content, more happy, rather than being, you know, an insurgent and defiant. And I'm going to go in there and start breaking furniture. We're seeing a different, maybe an ever so slightly more mellow version of Donald Trump, but his views are still the same. His agenda is still the same. And he has transformed the Republican Party. Now he is transforming American politics. And it looks like his influence is not limited to this country. You may have heard that Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, is on the verge of losing his government. When Justin Trudeau does lose his government, and it's inevitable, it's going to happen soon, you can give Donald Trump some of the credit for that one as well. So this is someone with much more influence than he had when he won in 2016. And the reason for it, quite frankly, was the range of his victory. He didn't just eke out enough electoral votes in swing states to win. He won all the swing states. And he didn't just win the presidency, but with his coattails, the Republicans won 53 seats in the Senate, and they maintained control of the House of Representatives. It's a tight majority, yes, but the Democrats had a 75% to 80% chance of winning the House of Representatives, we were told, all the way to Election Day. It didn't happen. So, and of course, he won the popular vote. So that's one of the reasons that the left has really been thrown off their game. They can't say that, well, he's not really the choice of the American people, just a majority in the swing states because of our outmoded, heavily outdated electoral college system. Well, he would have won it whether it was a popular vote or the Electoral College. And by the way, Democrats didn't mind the Electoral College when it was working more in their favor. So it will be interesting to see if there is a shutdown tomorrow. And my guess is the American people, just the fact that it had that pay raise in there. This is everything Americans hate about politics, is when the politicians appear to be looking out for themselves before they solve problems, and then they get sneaky about it. Oh, Americans are so done with that. So good on Donald Trump for pressing ahead. We have a lot of other things happening here, the commute with Carlson. I wanted to get into this, and now there are more details spilling forth. Again, this is just another great sign that regular, everyday, ordinary Washington folks are pushing back. I had mentioned last week that a group of school districts has proposed amending the WIAA, that's the Washington Interscholastic Athletic Association handbook, to create a new division in boys and girls sports that would prevent boys from participating in girls' athletic competition. The language of these proposals, there's a pair of them, and they're going to go in one direction or the other. I'll get into those details in a moment, will be finalized next month when the 53-member WIAA Assembly meets on January 27th. There are 6 districts throughout Washington State. The number of delegates allocated each district is based on the number of schools within each district. The assembly will then vote in April on whether to accept these one or both amendments. It'll have to be one or the other because it's giving them 2 different choices. An amendment requires 60% approval, so 32 of the 53 members have to vote accordingly. One of the measures would say that there will be 2 leagues. There will be a girls' league, and then there will be an open league, where, you know, otherwise known as the boys' league, where trans athletes of either gender can also participate. The other proposes a boys' league, a girls' league, and then basically an open league for others who want to participate without choosing boy or girl. I like the first proposal more, because it's simpler and it's clearer. The Linden School District and school districts in Brewster, Cashmere, Colville, Grand Coulee Dam School District, Lake Chelan, Mansfield, Meade, Okanagan, Omak, Oroville, Tenasket, they've all signed on to the proposal. As you see, most of these districts are from eastern Washington.
Yeah, or the outlying portions of the King County metro area.
Yes, or outlying.
I think a lot of this got started by school districts up in Whatcom County.
And a lot of the reason you're seeing special attention on this is last summer, a boy who says he identifies as a girl, goes by the name Veronica Garcia, won the 400-meter girls championship. And also in middle school, an eighth grade boy won the 1600-meter race at the Junior Olympics in Kashmir. Again, you're probably saying, why are boys participating in girls' sports? Well, it's because they're allowed to. The current requirement, the current policy, simply allows a boy who says he feels like a girl, that he identifies as a girl, can participate in girls' sports. The policy was put together by Aiden Key, who is the director of an organization called Gender Diversity. It's a Seattle-based organization. He's written a book called Trans Children in Today's Schools. And again, it allows people, you don't need a doctor. There's no involvement by medical authorities. It simply is a teenager who says, I identify more as a girl than my chosen gender, or my assigned gender. Rather than my natural, they should call it your natural biological gender. And yes, there could be girls who identify as guys, but that's not a problem if they want to participate in guys' sports because they don't have a natural biological advantage. Boys do. So when they participate in girls' sports, they have an unfair advantage. Again, this shouldn't be about politics. It is because the left denies the association of science and gender. They deny the association of biology and gender. Gender, yeah, that might be the, you might have an XY chromosome and you might have male private parts, but if you identify as a girl, then you are a girl. And who is anyone to tell you different? That's the current policy in place. And of course, no surprise, the person behind this policy says that, quote, that according to the Seattle Times article, quote, the current policy works as intended, close quote. He says, we are learning, which means as we learn and as we put steps in place, we can reflect on the effectiveness and adjust this. These proposals from these school districts are not an adjustment. They're looking to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Well, it exists. It is a problem that exists if you're a girl. And if you're participating in girls' sports and if you're losing opportunities, everything from a spot on the varsity squad to a championship because a boy is running in your race or competing in your sport. So good for you, all these districts, for showing the leadership that you don't see in King County. Good for them for pushing back. They are correct. They're going to win eventually. And this is happening nationally. We are seeing a pushback, and it's welcome. It is long overdue. And by the way, it's so obvious. It's so obvious that we need to make these things fair and that boys playing girls sports, young men playing women's collegiate sports is not fair. It is 21 minutes after 7. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with this morning's social media sweep. The Commute with Carlson continuing. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning. Okay, Burl, I'll do my best. John Carlson here, Talk Radio 570 KVI with young Zach and Philip J. Vandervoort III telling us what's going on in the social media world.
We don't get too many Burls anymore.
I was just going to say, right? If my wife's listening, I'd like to toss that out when we have a kid one day. What about Burl?
Burl Wafang.
Yeah, I like it.
I don't know. There's two people in America named Burl that I know of. There was a former disc jockey named Burl Bear.
Okay.
Back in the KOL, KJR,
okay. Seattle
rock and
radio
roll
history.
Rivalry day. And then there's Burl Ives, and that's about it.
Yeah.
They're all former somethings. There's no current Burls.
Yeah. There's a few barrels out there, but not Burls. Okay.
Yeah, you're right. The craft spirits world has grown large here the last dozen years or so. Okay, let's get to the social. Well, no, social's on social media next hour. Yeah, social media sweep right now. Sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. You've been talking about this congressional budget agreement that fell apart. It's called the Omnibus Spending Bill because it encompasses everything. Thus the word omni. And Elon Musk, who you talked about, is not a fan of this. He's suggested it get scrapped and start over, and basically suggesting that there needs to be a better budget agreement here. He posted a picture of the omnibus bill. It's 1,500 pages. I think I've got the number right here.
Yeah, it is. 1,537 pages.
I've got 1,547, but sure, 1,500 pages. And it's a visual post here. This is stacked up on a tabletop in a congressional office somewhere, but it looks like about three Seattle-Tacoma phone books from back in the day when we all used to have phone books. It looks like about three Seattle-Tacoma phone books thick stacked on top of each other on this table. So that's what you're talking about with 1,500 pages of congressional planning and budgeting. Okay. On social media, the host of the largest show on X, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but he's a founder and investor, 1.8 million followers. Name is Mario Nafal, and he posted a little nugget that he found in this 1,500-page congressional omnibus spending bill. And Mario Nafal writes, buried in the bill is a provision transferring RFK Stadium, the site in Washington, D.C., setting the stage for a new Washington Commanders NFL stadium. The NFL rakes in over $20 billion annually, doesn't need public subsidies, yet Congress is giving them a prime site for billionaire owners to cash in without even asking taxpayers. Lawmakers call it economic development, but let's be honest. It's a taxpayer-funded playground for NFL elites, lobbyists, and VIPs, while schools, healthcare, infrastructure are left on the bench.
How much? How much would...
Well, it doesn't necessarily say that there's a dollar value attached to this, but it basically approves some new site that would be developed for a new stadium. So stuffed into a must-pass bill, there's little time for oversight or for taxpayers to question why their money is being leveraged for luxury suites and skyboxes. And some of this is being also reported by the Associated Press. So there you go. A couple weeks ago, I think we talked about this on the social media sweep in Seattle, the Seahawks stadium. People were pointing out, why are there so many away and visiting fans that are in attendance at these ballgames where the Seahawk fans used to be so loud and domineering and making it difficult on the opposing offense to hear their play calls and things like that? And one of the Seattle sports writers is Greg Bell, Seahawk writers, and apparently DK Metcalf, the key player for the Seahawks, is now speaking out about this. He was asked about why it was so loud with Green Bay fans on Sunday night's game. And DK Metcalf said, quote, I'm wishing the 12s didn't sell as many tickets as they did to make sure we keep the home field advantage, end quote. So what fans were noticing, now players are starting to notice.
Well, I noticed it during the Green Bay game.
Oh, yeah.
It was unmistakable.
It was obvious, watching the game. And like I think you and I discussed a couple of weeks ago when I had found social media posts to that effect, people were wondering, why are so many people selling their Seahawk tickets to away and visiting fans? It ruins that home field advantage, but... obviously, fans noticed it. You noticed it watching the latest Seahawk-Green Bay game. But now the players are apparently starting to notice, too.
It is 7:30, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, a chilling poll. 41% of young adults consider the ambush murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson acceptable. 41% of young adults under 30. And we've also got it broken down by how people feel about it based on their political party. Wait until you hear that coming right around the corner on The Commute with Carlson. It's 24 minutes to 8 o'clock, Thursday morning, December 19th edition of The John Carlson Show. It's about the time you men out there start your Christmas shopping. Women were much smarter about this, already got a lot of it taken care of. Us guys still got to head out. All right. Here is chilling information from a brand new poll from Emerson College polling. 68%, this is the good part of the poll, 68% of people found that the actions of the man accused of shooting and murdering UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson to be unacceptable. But a stunning 41% of young adults found that it was acceptable. Break it down here. 24% of 18 to 29-year-olds, that's one in four, said that shooting and killing a healthcare company CEO in the back was somewhat acceptable. 17%, that's one in every seven voters, or one in every seven young people. 17% say they find that completely acceptable. You have to be living in a world where you are so dulled and desensitized by virtual reality and video game that you become divorced from rudimentary human thinking. Brian Thompson grew up in a small town in Iowa, worked the fields growing up, was accepted to Iowa State University, met a girl, got married, and went into the healthcare business, and eventually became CEO of one of the largest and most popular healthcare companies. United Healthcare is the nation's leader in selling supplemental insurance coverage to help seniors pay for things that Medicare won't cover. And he's a bad guy? The man who shot him, who's accused of shooting him, Luigi Mangione, it isn't even a customer of United Healthcare. Mr. Thompson is not a particularly controversial guy. I mean, he wasn't under indictment. He wasn't known for any kind of notorious policy or any notorious comments or notorious behavior. Didn't matter. 41% of adults under 30 considered the ambush murder, the assassination, really, of Mr. Thompson acceptable simply because he's CEO of a large healthcare company.
And you had indicated that this revolves around the detachment from reality and the detachment from morality. What about the ends justifying the means based on a lot of the political viewpoint that comes from younger Americans?
The divorce between I want these ends and the way you go about solving a problem is, again, something that's just startling here.
It just seems so prevalent
now when
on that side of the political spectrum.
When it comes to political spectrums, almost one in four Democrats say they found the murder of Brian Thompson to be acceptable. 22% of Democrats say they found the killing of Brian Thompson acceptable.
Staggering.
Only 12% of Republicans felt the same way, and even that is unsettling.
That's really unconnected.
But back to young people here, those numbers, 41%, are just head-shaking. And then I came across this. This is a post from Greg Eisenberg. He said, I just had a fascinating lunch with a 22-year-old Stanford University grad. Smart kid, perfect resume, but something felt off. He kept pausing mid-sentence, searching for words to express himself. Not complex words, just basic ones, like his brain was buffering. It got so bad that Eisenberg asked this Stanford grad, are you okay? And the young man answered back, and Eisenberg said his response floored me. Quote, sometimes I forget words now. I'm so used to having ChatGPT complete my thoughts that when it's not there, my brain feels slower. In other words, ChatGPT now does his thinking for him, and when it doesn't, he didn't know what to say.
Well, and so much of that with writing and words is memory recall, and if you don't exercise that continual recall, you're bound to forget. That seems to be what I'm hearing him explain.
Just as, you know, the calculators we all have on our smartphones often give people a substitute. You don't have to figure things out in your head. You don't have to do...
Or go write it out by hand, right?
You know, simple, basic arithmetic. You don't have to do that kind of thinking. You just need to press a button. It's one thing for a problem doing a math equation. It's another thing for completing a sentence.
Hey, you see it as a bad thing. I see that as one less young person vying for a talk radio position.
Yes. Less competition amongst us.
I'll take it.
Yeah, don't even have to complete your thoughts. Anyway, back to this young man, 22-year-old Stanford grad who had trouble completing a sentence and finding the words to use to carry on a conversation. And he said, sometimes I forget words. I'm so used to having ChatGPT complete my thoughts. He has been using AI, artificial intelligence, for everything. He uses AI to write, to think, to communicate. AI had become his external brain. And now his internal brain was getting weaker.
I mean, it comes back to use it or lose it. You know, if you're not exercising this part of your brain, you're not going to have that memory recall.
He said, we are running the first large-scale experiment on human cognition. What happens when an entire generation outsources their thinking? He said, don't get me wrong. This is Greg Eisenberg again. Don't get me wrong. I'm excited about what AI and AI agents will do for people in the same way that I was excited in 2009 when the App Store was launched. But thinking out loud, you got to think this guy I met isn't the only one that's going to be completely dependent on AI.
Yeah, you'd think that the folks that are going to Stanford would probably be able to generate a lot of this on their own rather than relying on a ChatGPT, whereas lesser schools, that's where the students might be relying more on ChatGPT.
Somebody responded to his post by saying, reminds me of the story of London cab drivers' brains having larger than average sized hippocampi due to them having to memorize the streets and routes to do their jobs without relying on external aids.
Yeah, you can't stop and look at the map. It just wastes your time as a taxi driver. You're not going to pick up as many fares. If you know all this stuff by heart, you just go through it much faster.
So again, this is the latest where you now have AI doing the thinking for young, intelligent people who graduate from elite universities to the point where they have trouble carrying on a conversation because they're just used to having AI complete their thoughts for them. That would be a downside of AI, as promising a technology as it is in many other ways. But that is a real thing that is happening. You got 12 minutes to 8 o'clock when we come back. A very respected colleague calls it a day after 47 years behind the microphone. Couple of words of appreciation for the life and career of Dave Ross. 53 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning, or 7 minutes to 8. Well, it was sign-off day for, well, it's officially today, December 19th, for Dave Ross, former colleague of mine at Cairo. I was doing TV when he was doing radio. He used to have me in as an occasional guest, and few people have done radio as well as Dave has, and he's been at it a long time. He started in the 1970s, 47 years behind the mic, the last 10 years with Colleen O'Brien, who I knew when she was with Como Radio.
Before she went to
before moving
Spokane and then coming back?
And then moving, getting the co-anchor seat at Cairo with Mr. Ross. But Colleen O'Brien is a former colleague at Como Radio. He has done it all. And he's picked up a pile of awards. He's won 5 Murrow Awards, very prestigious. He's reported around the world. He used to have his own morning midday show, and more recently has been behind the microphone in the morning, doing both, I guess you could say, news anchoring.
Yeah, news talk a little bit.
Some commentary.
Conversational,
well.
Topical stuff. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been one of our competitors, really, in the morning.
And, you know, I have known him a long time. He actually took some time off, ran for Congress in 2004,
yeah,
20
right.
years ago.
For the district that Adam Smith currently has, right?
I think so. It's the 8th district, which is partly the 9th.
Yeah, after it got switched around years
but,
ago.
Yeah, but it was Dave Reichert who defeated him, barely. Dave Ross came close, and if Dave had run 2 years 2 years after, if he had made another run, he would have beat Dave, because 2006 was a very good year for Democrats. And Dave elected to stay behind the microphone after, again, coming very close but just missing for a seat in Congress from the 8th Congressional District. He's known for his deep baritone
voice. He's a wee man. with a very big booming deep voice.
You would never know it
looking
at, yes. If he doesn't have a 6 foot 4 inch physique, but he does have a 6 foot 4 inch
voice. Yes, he does.
And we will miss him. Again, 47 years, and today is his last day. So, Dave, you've earned a good retirement. Our old friend from Como, Charlie Harger, will be stepping in to take his place. Colleen is stepping away from the microphone as well.
One other quick item about Dave. He was on the air in the 2001 February 28th 6.8 earthquake. Mm-hmm. He was on the mic and started realizing that the whole building was shaking when the earthquake hit.
Yes. So with Dave Ross now out, I guess that means that the dean of News Talk Radio in Seattle is now John Carlson.
Hey, how about that?
I was going to say Amanda Factor.
31 years.
Listen to young Zach.
All right. Congratulations on a great run, Dave Ross. Congratulations, Colleen. Enjoy your well-deserved next chapters in life. It is 3 minutes to 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock in the morning, still dark out there. The darkest or the shortest day of the year will be coming up a day after. Well, it'll be tomorrow, won't it? Isn't tomorrow the winter solstice?
Maybe technically Saturday. I think it's Saturday? The 21st.
All right. Yeah. 20,
right in that vicinity.
But it's going to look a lot like it does right now here for the next few weeks. Welcome to hour number 3 of the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. I appreciate you letting me be part of your listening day. But you know that this is a news program for people who pay attention, because how many other people 6 days before Christmas are talking about the Washington state budget, the proposed Washington budget. Jay Inslee is, and the one-party regime in Olympia is talking about a $12 billion shortfall. That is not a gap between the existing budget and the money coming in, because state revenue has actually been going up. That is a four-year anticipated shortfall for what the Democrats want to spend. Again, this deficit is a deficit only if they keep spending the way they have been spending. That's important for you to consider. And we'll be talking about that at 8:35. Right now, this is one of my favorite stories of the day. I love it. I absolutely love it when we see a person, a property owner in this case, pushing back against the government for essentially trying to throw its weight around and demand things it has no right demanding. Now, in this case, it has to do with a guy who lives out in Edmonds, Nathan Rimmer. He had purchased a vacant lot and wanted to build on that lot and was told by the city of Edmonds, sure you can, but we want you to plant some trees. And he said, well, okay, but I don't want to, and it's my land. And they said, well, if you want to build on this lot that you own, you'll do what we want you to. And Nathan said, no, that's not how it's supposed to work in a free country. And he stood his ground. He joins us on the John Carlson Show this morning. Nathan, how you doing?
Yeah, John, good morning.
Good morning. Tell us a little more about this story here.
Yeah, I mean, you summed it up there. I mean, we had purchased this lot. It had a small ornamental tree right in the middle of the lot. And in order to build a house on it, we were going to need to remove the tree. And the city said, okay, that's fine, but you're going to plant two new trees on your lot if we let you take this tree off of your property. And then you're also going to put a covenant on your title, which they called it a notice, but that had the words grantee and grantor on it, which, conveys something, right? So they said, you'll also go take this down to the recorder's office and have it recorded forever on your property. And you're going to make sure that those trees, so that we as the city can make sure those trees never are removed from this property. And once you do all that, we'll give you the building permit for this house. And we said no. We said no about five times, and they kept coming back to this over and over and over again. And we really kind of narrowed it down to this one issue. And finally, they said, we're going to expire your permit if you don't comply with this order, and we're just not going to give you the permit. You're going to have to start all over again. So I contacted Pacific Legal Foundation and got good guys. We'd worked with them, knew of their work, and sure, had worked with them in the past, just as an observer and as somebody who appreciates their work. And they, fortunately, they agreed to take the case, and we worked together and put this lawsuit together. And we still demanded it from the city that they drop this condition that was in their tree ordinance, their newly passed tree ordinance, and ended up going to court. We were granted summary judgment from the bench by the judge.
Now tell our listeners what that means.
It means that the judge just summarily agreed with everything that we argued in our case. And so he ruled in our favor from the bench. The city was required to issue the permit without the tree conditions on it. And it was just now, this was earlier this year. And finally, just this last week, he issued the written decision. So we'll see what happens with the appeal. It seems like the city wants to appeal from the indications they've made, which I don't know. I don't really understand that the city of Edmonds has a $20 million deficit they're facing, but I guess
they have money for this.
I guess they have extra money to throw around at things like this. So, yeah, but I think at the core of our case, what I really, want to emphasize was that, and I think the judge, he did a really good job understanding the facts and really tying this back to constitutional case law. I mean, it really wasn't, it was a tree in this case, but, mm-hmm. And those are kind of like a favored class of a property, if you will, in the state these days. It's kind of the fad around a lot of cities is to, use these highly restrictive tree ordinances to control what you can and can't do on your property, to take up space on your property. But the judge kind of saw right through that and said, you can't use a tree ordinance to and trees to dictate what people do on their property. But furthermore, he said, imposing this onto a property owner, saying you may not want this property, but you're going to have to take it if you want us to issue a building right. permit. And this really ties back to, Nolan Dolan was right. kind of that original case, which actually Pacific Legal Foundation.
Down in California.
Right. Yeah. Went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they were, in that case, they were trying to, the California Coastal Commission was trying to essentially extort an easement off of a property owner's front of his property in order to.
Yeah. Basically, they were demanding land if a guy wanted a permit.
Correct. Yep, exactly. And the U.S. Supreme Court saw right through that. And that work that Pacific Legal did, over 50 years ago now, really kind of set the stage for cases like this. And, you just have to keep pushing back because they keep coming up with new schemes, right? I don't think that 40 or 50 years ago, probably nobody thought about trees being the issue, but that just seems to be kind of the issue of the day.
It's not just the tree. It's not just the tree. It's the principle behind it. I tell you what, let's bring in Brian Hodges, because Brian is an attorney with Pacific Legal Foundation. They were the group that argued that precedent-setting Supreme Court case back in 1987 that Nathan Rimmer here is referring to, the Nolan case, and they handled Nathan's showdown with the city of Edmonds. Mr. Hodges, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Thanks for having me this morning.
So how significant is this case in Edmonds between Nathan Rimmer and the city over a mandate for a couple of trees?
It's actually very significant. This doctrine that started with Nolan, I like to think of, and it's, I guess, the proper season for this, I like to think of it as government porch pirates. They see an application for a benefit, whether it's a land use permit or something else that you have to ask government permission for, and they say, well, what can we get from this? That's not the proper role of government. The right to build on your property zoned for residential use is fundamental, and they cannot hold that right hostage just to get some benefit, something that they want. What's in it for me? The doctrine says that when the government makes a demand that an owner give up their property, they have to justify it. So if it's to mitigate for some negative external impact, like, you're going to redirect water onto your neighbor's property or onto the street, sure, they can make you do that, but they can't use you as an ATM.
Right. Well, the other thing, and I've got Nathan Rimmer and Brian on together. The other thing that is amazing here is that supposedly We have a problem with affordable housing in Washington state. And instead of finding ways to help people build housing, they're looking for ways to hold up the construction of housing because there are other things that have nothing to do with home building that they want.
Yeah, and it's not only holding up housing. They call them exactions, these demands that are put on building permits. The cost of exactions has been known for decades to drive up the cost of market rate housing because everything that a developer has to pay is going to be even more when it comes to the purchase price of the house. So not only is housing being delayed, it's also being driven up by these grabs, these property grabs and money grabs that are being imposed on permits. And one point I wanted to make that makes Nathan's case so important is this latest decision that we got from the judge last week held the city liable for violating Nathan's federal civil rights under the Civil Rights Act, Section 1983, which means that the city can be held liable for all the damages caused when it monkeyed around, refused to issue his permit for a period of almost 2 years. And they, on top of it, are going to have to pay our attorney fees for the, now it's been well over a year it's taken just to get this condition removed from his permit.
Let me ask both of you, why didn't the city of Edmonds just say, oh, this might go in a direction we don't want, just toss in your hand?
You know, you could speculate on why. I mean, I think that they had this shiny new object in the form of this tree ordinance that they had just recently passed, and they didn't want to give it up. And the city, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, they're in a big hole. The city's not been well run. They got really bullheaded on this particular issue. But again, if you just look at their budget situation that they're dealing with, right? I mean, they're looking at disbanding their police force.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out what to do up there. It's just been really, really mismanaged. And so I don't know. Somebody got an idea that they just wanted to push this forward and they didn't want to let go.
Again, the city of Edmonds, which is in a huge financial hole to the point where they are thinking of disbanding their police department and contracting with Snohomish County to provide police, they have the money to push another, you know, take it another round and see if they can find a way to force Nathan Rimmer here to put in two new trees and then have to agree in perpetuity to maintain those trees. They could never go away.
And I think you make a good point, John, about the housing situation, though. You know, it's interesting, after this initially had come out, when the oral decision was made, the ruling from the bench, a civil engineer I work with, we work in land use and real estate, he caught wind of it and he said, boy, if I would have known this, we could have tried to take a similar case. He said, we were doing an affordable housing project in the city of Seattle, and this was a government funded, largely government funded project. He said, we had to work around the tree to a point where we ended up losing about 20 affordable housing units. Actually, it was an emergency shelter. That's what an emergency response because of this one tree. And, you know, these stories are just like, they go on and on. Most people just kind of sweep them under the rug and they just want to move on. And so you're right. All of these things have a compounding effect on reducing the number of beds available in the city, the number of homes available in the city. And it's just one after the other.
Mr. Hodges, two quick questions for you as time grows short. The first is, would this have been different if Nathan wanted to cut down a tree on his property? Because these tree ordinances not only sometimes want, you know, new development to put in trees, but they want to prevent existing homeowners from taking them down.
No, that actually was the situation on the ground here. There was a tree in the middle of the lot that needed to be removed in order to build a home. And they said, if you cut that, and it was just a small ornamental tree, if you cut that, you have to plant two new ones and then deed the or restrict the property that you where you plant them.
Unbelievable. It really is. And second, could this be Nolan too? Again, it's not really about trees. It's about a principle behind the trees. Could this conceivably, if they push it, will it go to federal court and potentially be Nolan too?
Well, if they push it, it does have the possibility. There are some more questions. PLF just recently argued the Sheets case, Sheets v. County of El Dorado, up to the U.S. Supreme Court. to resolve. There was a split among the national courts as to whether legislative demands like this tree ordinance are subject to the same heightened scrutiny that Nolan requires.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court said, yes, of course, the Constitution applies to every branch of government. Why are you carving out an exception for one branch? There are issues that could arise in Nathan's case that could justify going up, but Edmonds would have to take it up because we won at the first level.
Nathan
we'll
Rimmer,
see what their next move is.
Nathan Rimmer, thank you for fighting back and standing your ground. Brian Hodges from Pacific Legal Foundation, thanks for carrying the fight into the judicial ring there. Congratulations, both of you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Take care.
It's 21 minutes after 8 o'clock. You know what that means. Philip J. Vandervoort III with his favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists on The John Carlson Show. Good morning. All right, Philip J. Vandervoort III, name that movie.
Just going to say, this is a request from listener Argyle from Die Hard 1988. We are halfway through Die Hard, or at least one of our several December screenings at the house.
MAGA's favorite Christmas song, ladies and gentlemen, or favorite Christmas movie, ladies and gentlemen,
right, yeah.
Die Hard.
For sure.
For love that movie. That used to be my tradition when everyone else went to bed on the evening of December 23rd. I'd stay up late, watch Die Hard, and wrap presents.
Yep. That's a good tradition.
All right. Here's another great tradition. Social media from socialists. What do you got?
Yeah, a lot of congressional stuff I want to plug in here. Good. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This is a congressman from Texas, a Democrat from Texas, East Austin and West San Antonio. So those are definitely two of the more liberal areas of greater Texas. Greg Kassar is his name. Greg Kassar. And he posts, today I'm leading 20 members of Congress to demand that President Biden's administration withhold offensive weapons from the Israeli military. U.S. law is clear. If the Netanyahu government does not allow sufficient food and medicine to enter Gaza, then the U.S. cannot send weapons. Now, I'm just going to scroll through here and see when the last time that Texas Congressman Greg Kassar has posted about demanding that hostages held by Hamas get released. I'm scrolling
here. Keep looking.
Back to December 17th.
Got
to
be there somewhere.
December 15th.
It's not going to be there. No.
Nope, that's not it on the 14th. That's not it on December 13th.
Because if Hamas released...
I guess he doesn't really have a big priority on releasing hostages held by Hamas.
If Hamas
compared to
release the
what
hostages,
Israel gets.
Then there would be no reason for Israel to withhold any kind of aid.
Here's a picture.
And by the way, they're not withholding aid as much as they are actually trying to get aid into the right hands because Hamas steals most of the aid that goes into the country and then they use it to buy weapons.
Yeah. Back to December 11th from this particular Democratic congressman in Texas. And he's got a picture of him and Ilhan Omar and Pramila Jayapal from Seattle and somebody else with the little placard of the Congressional Progressive Caucus in the background. But no, I still don't see anything about his concerns about hostages held for 16 months now by Hamas. Oh, okay. So thank you, Congressman, for that update on your views about Israel. Another Democratic congressional member, Rebecca Ballant from Vermont. She's a mom, teacher, Vermonter, writer, congresswoman for Vermont, fighting for working families, and is part of the House Budget Democratic Committee, or she's a Democratic member on the House Budget Committee. Okay. And Rebecca Ballant posted, Elon Musk is not an elected official. He's been elected to nothing and has no place inserting himself like he's the president when Congress is trying to get disaster relief to those who need it.
How dare you express an opinion on a subject that's counter to mine, she said.
Just because you're in America and you run a couple of businesses, you don't have any opportunity to sound off on what Congress is up to.
Well, here's
thanks for that instructive civics lesson, Congresswoman Ballant.
Elon's response should say, are you spending your own money or the public's?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the public's? Yeah. Well, that means you're spending my money. And if I have an opinion, you bet I'll voice it. Good for him. All right. As I mentioned about 20 minutes ago, you know that this is a show with an unusually intelligent listening audience because Even during this time of year, we are thinking about things like the next state budget and Jay Inslee's attempt to get his successor to push for something he never pushed for, a wealth tax, which is simply a tax you would pay because of how much money you're worth, not for what you spend, not for what you buy, not for what you invest, but simply for having wealth, simply for being worth a certain amount of money. They will tax you a percentage of it. We're going to talk with a rising star in the Washington State Legislature on the Republican side of the spectrum. What does he think about the upcoming budget? And is there really a huge deficit, or is that just political talk? It's all straight ahead on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. And we're back. The radio program of record, The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. By the way, January 20th will be a very special day. And, of course, that'll be the inauguration of President Trump. If you don't have plans, well, why don't you consider hanging out with us? We'll have a special announcement for you on tomorrow morning's show. So again, if you're not busy on Monday, January 20th, and you'd like to be part of history, well, why don't you be part of history instead of just watching it at home or, you know, a TV at work or wherever? Why don't you come hang out with us? All right. Again, that's coming up on tomorrow's show. Right now, Jay Inslee has unveiled his final budget proposal. It projects a $10 to $12 billion shortfall over the next 4 years. But again, that's not a shortfall based on the amount of money we have now. It's a shortfall based on the amount of money he wants to spend. And one of his suggested ways of closing this gap is the creation of a new tax simply for being wealthy, not for what you spend, not for what you invest, not for property you own, not a property tax, just simply for being wealthy. Have a listen.
This is an entirely new economy that we have that I believe the state and the nation has to respond to this inequity beyond human imagination. We cannot survive as a healthy, robust community that believes we're treated fairly while we have this level of poverty and want amidst this enormous wealth.
Okay, my first response to that is, you've been there for 12 years. This has all happened on your watch, okay? This, quote, entirely new economy, which is not entirely new at all, but it's all happened with you there, Jay. It's all happened with you. So how much of this are you responsible for? And is it really a bad thing that there are companies that are so successful that their stock price has soared, which has created unexpected, unanticipated, unimaginable wealth for many people? All right. There's more you need to know about this budget and about that idea from a rising star in the Washington legislature. We like having him on the show every so often, and it'll be more often with the legislative session underway next month. Travis Couture, he is from Mason County, Shelton area. He joins me this morning on The Commute with Carlson. How are you, Travis?
Great, John. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. Assume I'll be seeing you at Roanoke late next month.
Of course. Of course.
The Roanoke Conference. We love the Roanoke Conference. However, I've got to get your take. Let's start with what Jay Inslee says about this massive, new, unexpected inequality from our entirely new economy.
Well, I couldn't agree with you anymore about your comments just a minute ago. He's been there for 12 years, and basically we've had Democrat control for 40 straight years. Republicans are basically like the Israelites lost in the wilderness here. That's about the same amount of time that Democrats have been in charge. And so if we're going to be blaming this quote-unquote new economy, they could just look in the mirror. Another thing that Jay Inslee points at is how we need to desperately help our food bank. Well, we have one of the highest costs of groceries in the entire nation, higher than California. We wouldn't need food banks so much if their policies didn't make our food at our grocery stores so expensive.
No one's going to argue that point. And, of course, I don't think that stopping the merger is going to take us a step closer to more affordability between Albertsons and Kroger. That's a side issue. We don't want to get, you know, bogged down in that. Tell us what people need to know about this deficit. I'm using air quotes. Deficit, and which supposedly justifies these new taxes that are going to be proposed. And tell us what the real budget picture is, Travis Couture.
Yeah. So first of all, just kind of like you pointed out, we're not in a $10 to $15 billion debt. It is a projected deficit. This is money that we promised to spend. We don't have to promise to spend it. We can just go back to just a handful of years ago to fix this budget as far as how much we want to spend. But, you know, Washington Research Council has been looking at this thing since 2021, and they accurately predicted, and Republicans have been accurately predicting that we would be in big trouble. We're not in a recession. We didn't need new revenues because the legislature has already raised taxes and fees 50 times in the last 10 years. We had more revenue than ever before, but the Democrats just went on a reckless spending spree. And as a result, when everybody, even the Seattle Times, is asking for fiscal responsibility from the majority party, what do they go and do? The governor proposes the largest tax increase in state history and then couples it with another $10, $11 billion in new spending. But here's the problem, John. That's just the tip of the iceberg. When we go into the session, what we can expect is that Democrats in the legislature will propose even more taxes because the governor's budget doesn't include all of their new spending that they want for their pet projects and the elites in their district, because what Olympia actually serves now is the well-connected in Olympia. I call it subsidies for the elite. It doesn't actually serve people, because in the state of Washington, what we do is we educate, we medicate, and we incarcerate. And right now we have less people in our prisons, less kids in our K-12 schools than ever before, less people going to our higher education institutions, and less people on Medicaid. So where is this need for more critical services? The caseload just doesn't exist. They just keep giving more money to their buddies, including Jay Inslee. When he leaves, will probably become rich from the CCA.
Okay, a little Climate Commitment Act you're referring to. So let's get a little more specific, because I like where you're going on this. If it's not, if we're not using more money to educate, to medicate, and to incarcerate because of falling caseloads in all three areas, if we're not doing that, then what is the money being spent for?
Yeah, it's a great question. Right now in our budget, 20 to 25% of the money that's being spent currently is non-mandatory spending. And I would even venture to say that some of this other 75% of the mandatory spending is on the table in one way, shape, or form. But that's where you start. And there is thousands, I don't think people understand, just thousands and thousands and thousands of line items of spending. And then there's options within those line items to dial them up or dial them down, right? And so there's we got a lot of employees. And when we talk about $10 to $12 billion, it'll be 15 here coming very soon when the receipts come in for collective bargaining agreements, for vendor rates, for so many other little things that we're going to be getting the bill for coming soon. And none of them are new policies.
So here is, as someone who's been around crossroads of media and politics for a long time, here's what I think you need to do. Because it's not just the general public that needs to wake up to Olympia and its spending culture. It's the media. So pick three things. The three most outrageous, indefensible areas of state spending, line items that the Democrats want to raise taxes to keep paying. And keep emphasizing those three issues over and over and over again. Don't get tired of doing it over and over again until the general public realizes just how ridiculous this is. Because the one thing about Olympia is oftentimes the Republicans will make a point, and, you know, they'll have a press conference and there'll be a press release and there'll be social media, and they might even go in for another round of press releases and speeches on the floor, and then they move on. And everyone in Olympia knows what the Republicans talked about, but 97% of the general public, the message never got to them, because you have to keep talking about something over and over and over again before it sinks in. The Democrats understand this well, as we saw with the abortion issue. They just keep talking about it over and over again until people who don't pay attention to politics end up knowing about it and hearing about it because it's unavoidable. So pick three things and, you know, shake it like a dog with a bone and don't quit. Keep going and going and going at it, Travis.
Yeah, absolutely, John. And I couldn't agree with you anymore. We have to, and I say we as in Republicans in the legislature, have to do a better job of essentially marketing what we're doing and making sure that those words get to the actual people that need to hear them the most, because just saying it on the floor isn't good enough. Nobody really watches TVW. So we have a very concerted effort coming into next session to really, as far as the budget goes, expose what's inside the budget in a very impactful way that people can see. But then also we're going to be coming up with a Republican budget alternative, and we're going to be showing people the difference, and we're going to be making a lot of noise about it. And to your point, we're going to be pointing out those line items, like, you know, and they might be smaller line items, but maybe we shouldn't be hiring gender-affirming doctors for transgender inmates and doing laser hair removal for them.
Boom. There's one right there. Laser hair removal for transgender inmates. Boom. That's one right there. You cannot lose with that.
Nope. And I mean, there's a lot more ridiculous things too. Like, you know, we spend a lot of money in something called HEAL grants to teach women about, you know, how to empower women about climate change and stuff like that. I mean, there's just a lot of different kind of ridiculous things. I mean, Department of Commerce is a monolith for ridiculous grants. And so I am combing through that right now, and we're going to be making a lot of noise about it.
Perfect. Perfect. But that is your way to seize the initiative and throw the other guys on the defensive when it comes to the war over spending and taxes that is going to dominate this next legislature. Travis Couture, it's always great having you on the John Carlson Show. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks, John. Have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Travis. It is coming up here on 10 minutes to 9 o'clock, the radio program of record, cruising along. Good morning. 5 minutes to 9 o'clock. Hey, quick programming note for you KVI listeners looking for some good, clean holiday fun.
Yeah, no secret that I'm a massive fan of comedian Nate Bargatze. He's got a kind of cool opportunity tonight at 6 p.m. on CBS or Paramount Plus. He's doing Nate Bargatze's Nashville Christmas Variety Special. Darius Rucker, Carrie Underwood, Noah Kahan, Jelly Roll, and a few of the SNL cast members doing some skits and a couple comedians and stuff on the show. Should be a good time. Good, clean holiday fun for the family.
That's tonight,
6 p.m.
7, 6 p.m., CBS or Paramount Plus.
You got it.
If you have an expensive streaming service, make sure you're listening to tomorrow's special announcement for what we plan on Inauguration Day. It involves you. It involves you. So you don't want to miss this announcement. It's going to be tomorrow, okay? All right, get out there and enjoy the rest of the day.